Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
This podcast is a production of KCRW and KCRW.com Santa Monica. If you enjoy this program, check out KCRW.com for more than 20 additional programs that you can podcast.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
To understand the current writer's strike, you need to understand the long and contentious relationship between screenwriters and the people who write their checks. This week on The Business, part two of our conversation with Oscar-winning scribe Mark Norman about his new book, What Happens Next? A History of American Screenwriting. Plus, while the writers strike, video games rock on! Literally. Stick around, it's The Business from NPR. The writer's strike is dragging on, and to do our part to end the unpleasantness, we begin our show with these wise words from TV writer and producer Rob Long.
A few years ago, I heard this story from a friend of mine. He's got a kid in elementary school, and one day, in his oldest kid's second grade classroom, suddenly, without warning, all of the kids started to throw up. Just cascades, apparently, and for no discernible reason. So they shut down the school, they sent everybody home, they called out the hazmat crew, and they sent in the guys in the spacesuits to sniff around and measure stuff and check for gas and chemicals and E. coli and anything else that might make 26 seven-year-olds hurl and hurl and hurl and hurl. And they found nothing. That's right, nothing. See, apparently it was just that one of the kids, only one, had been suffering from a slightly upset stomach that morning, had suddenly felt queasy, and had yacked all over himself and his desk. Now, the sight, and let's be honest, the smell of which had inspired one or two of his closest neighbors to suddenly let loose on their own, which had a ripple effect throughout the class, from the side of the room with the hamster cage to the side of the room with the Let's Help the Earth posters, and suddenly an entire class was upchucking. The sound of retching echoed down the halls, the air was thick with the stench of bile and sick, and the floors were drenched and stuccoed with vomit. Which brings us to the writer's strike. I'm on strike. I'm not supposed to write anything for the screen or think anything for the screen or even think about thinking anything for the screen, which isn't such a terrible burden, really, because I'm an incredibly lazy person anyway, and I love having any excuse for not writing. I mean, if you want to punish me, make me write. Look, I'll be honest. I'm not crazy about this strike. I'm not at all certain that what we're going to get is going to be worth the cost, the lost spots on the broadcast schedule, the eroding attentions of an audience more interested in Facebook and Guitar Hero. And yet there's something so ham-fisted and ridiculous about the studio's position. I mean, honestly, we're talking about a few cents here and there, and something so old-mannish about their terrified position on possible internet revenue streams that it's hard not to grab a sign and march around acting like some kind of weird fantasy of myself, some kind of lead in a Clifford Odets play. Me, a guy with, let's face it, no real marketable skills, but who has nonetheless parlayed an ability to write funny words for other better-looking people to say into a nice sinecure. Look, the truth is, the web, you know, that thing that brings us email and MySpace and cats playing piano on YouTube, it's going to have a kind of a Walmart effect on the entertainment choices offered to the audience. A lot more to choose from. Most of it's pretty awful. All of it's going to be a lot cheaper. You know, Walmart. Now, when you combine the digitization of content with unlimited bandwidth, what you get is a cheaper, more efficient system. And Brentwood was not built on cheap or efficient. This town, and all of us who work here, all of us, writers, agents, actors, lawyers, studio executives, all of us, here in the big second-grade classroom called Hollywood, we have a stake in preserving this great, big, slushy, inefficient mess of a system that makes pilots that never get aired and buys scripts that never get produced and makes movies that no one sees and produces series that get canceled. I mean, to my colleagues, I say, the web is going to force us to radically alter our expectations about residuals, and we'll probably end up getting less in the future. That's what market efficiencies do. Let's figure out how to adjust to that. To the studio, as I say, make a deal. Just swallow it and make a deal. I mean, you may think you can kill the WGA, and, you know, you probably can, but it'll be the first part of a murder-suicide pact. And if you don't believe me, call up somebody in the record business. If you can find one. The web's been visiting with them, too. Now, the kids on YouTube and Facebook aren't going to make you rich. Your box office is dwindling. Your ratings are dropping. Guitar Hero is not fattening Sumner Redstone's wallet. We are all in the second grade together. Let's stop throwing up on each other.
We're going to kindergarten to play out in the sun.
Rob Long is a writer and producer working in Hollywood. Well, he's not really working, but anyway, you know what I mean. We'll be hearing more about the aforementioned Guitar Hero video game later in the show, but next, more about the long and not always convivial relationship between screenwriters and the people who write their checks. The writer's strike is more or less about the writers wanting a bigger piece of new technology money. The studios, for their part, are saying, what money? No matter how you slice it, it's a terrible time for Hollywood to be hobbled by a strike. There are just so many other places people can go to entertain themselves. Movie and TV people should be aligned against those who would steal their audience. But screenwriters and the people who write their checks haven't been on the same page since back in the day, before the internet, even before TV, in the infancy of the movie business. Last week, we got some of the history of that dysfunctional relationship when we talked to Oscar-winning screenwriter Mark Norman about his new book, What Happens Next? A History of American Screenwriting. Here's his description of how the Hollywood moguls of yesteryear saw screenwriters and screenwriting.
None of them were quite sure what a screenwriter did or even how he did it. Certainly, he or she delivered an artifact, a screenplay, that worked or didn't. But where did it come from? The writer's typewriter delivered by a rocket ship from Pluto, or, even more terrible to contemplate, stolen from somebody else who owned the rights? Did it take them a year to write a screenplay, or only one day, and then they waited a year to hand it in? There was no telling because nobody could see the work occur. The screenwriter functioned in private, secluded, unwatchable, and so took on the uneasy taboo that surrounded all those who go off into forests or jungles to have some solipsistic experience. They weren't social, weren't good company, they didn't drink or f*** enough for the most part, they tended to be quiet, defensive, touchy. Because they'd seen the movie before anyone else, in the perfect theater of their brain, they tended to be possessive, individualistic, trying to control what everybody else on the picture did, but without the authority. They didn't have to deal with the Catholics, evangelists, ladies' church groups, and their mail campaigns. They were like football kickers, specialists. They didn't pitch in, didn't get tackled. They weren't part of the movie company, the gang that went on the floor and bashed the damn thing out. They finished their work before the company gathered and were gone when it began. How could anybody quantify what they were worth, put a fee against their labors? Perhaps any social system needs an other, negative to its positive, the counterpoint it needs to define itself. Screenwriters gradually became the other of the movie business. Schmucks with Underwoods, Jack Warner called them, and he was snarling.
Last week, we left off in the 1950s when the first generation of people who grew up on the movies and actually wanted to work in them arrived in town. We pick up our conversation in the 1960s when the balance of power in Hollywood shifted to directors and the auteur theory of filmmaking.
It was really a wrong-headed idea, and it was done by some French guys who were, 6,000 miles away from the business they were describing. There's a quote in the book from William Goldman, which I love, where he says, I don't even know a director who believes this thing.
But basically saying that the director is the be-all and end-all, meaning
right.
The screenwriter has absolutely nothing to do with it.
Right.
But the flip side of that, of course, is that the power shifts towards the creative people, the screenwriter included.
Well, yes, here it was that as the world and America began to look on movies as, I'm going to put it in quotation marks, an art form, because it kind of is and it kind of isn't, the Renaissance notion that, well, if you got an art form, it has to be created by an artist. It's not a committee. It's not a bunch of people getting together. It's one titanic person carving this out of stone. And the director became the obvious choice for that titanic person, whether it was true or not. A lot of directors, when they went to speak to student groups and the students would say, you're an auteur, the director would say, no, they brought me a script by motorcycle the day before I had to go shoot it. and the combination of the auteur theory, young people in America rediscovering movies in the 60s and 70s, basically by watching them on television. The rise of film school, all this kind of coalesced into the 70s, which was a great time for movie making. George Lucas described it as a small seam opening up, and a lot of very bright people who might have gone into other businesses or other fields or other creative fields came out to Hollywood to try and squeeze through that seam. And it was a great time.
But even though the great movies by a Coppola or a Lucas or a Spielberg were written by somebody, we think of them as Spielberg movies and Lucas movies.
Well, in the case of Lucas, he wrote them. In the case of Coppola, you know, he wrote them.
Okay, well, maybe bad examples.
No, it's a good example because what you're saying is that the foundation of auteurism are guys writing screenplays and then figuring out a way to go direct them and becoming auteurs. But before they could become auteurs, they had to learn how to write.
At what point do agents come into play in a big way for writers?
Well, agents for writers really came into their own with freelancing. Before, under the studio system, writers had agents, and the agents were people who basically went into the studios when a writer's contract would be near termination and argue for either a raise or maybe just for the writer to be kept on at his current salary. And the agent would take as good a deal as he could get and leave, and the writer would pay him 10% for that. With freelancing, the agent became not only the person who negotiated for the writer, but negotiated a new contract every time the writer worked. And so that agent could start bumping up the writer's price from screenplay to screenplay. There were just all these new negotiating opportunities. And the agents functioned that way for writers and also for directors and actors, and gain power because of that ability to negotiate.
And during this time, it seems like contracts, the writers' contracts did get better.
Yes.
And what are the things that they gained during this period?
Well, what writers gained was mainly a result of the union efforts more than contract negotiations. Writers have always been able to negotiate contracts over scale. Writers have always been able to basically get whatever the market can bear. Since the end of the studio system in terms of their contracts. But the great gains for writers have been gained by the union. And the great gains I'm talking about are a pension fund, a health plan. These were all things that prior to the union getting them, the writer had to pay out of pocket. And, you know, you can really look on the guild and its various confrontations with the industry as the most successful writers in the guild sacrificing for the least successful.
Right, because the guys at the top don't need it.
The guys at the top don't need it. They can always negotiate over scale. The benefits have really been for the men and women who are either trying to get in or who are on their way out or who are kind of marginal and exist from check to check. And I'm kind of proud of that in terms of the guild. That so many successful writers have been willing to sacrifice so much for people they don't know and might never meet.
Right. If you're just joining us, I'm Matt Holzman sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner. I'm speaking with Mark Norman. He's an Oscar-winning screenwriter who's written a book about the history of American screenwriting called What Happens Next. A note that Mark Norman is on the WGA's negotiating committee, so we've stayed away from specific details of the current strike. So now we're going to just keep flipping the calendar pages, and we're going to bring it up to the 80s where there is a kind of a return to the studio system in a way, or at least the power structure of the studio system.
Well, what you had was a generation of executives who, in as a way to sort of bring power back to the studios that the auteurs had kind of dissipated and usurped and in some ways trashed. To bring power back to the studios, the notion was, wait a minute, why do we have to deal with these highfalutin auteurs? Why don't we just come up with all the movie ideas ourselves? We're smart cookies. And at Paramount, with Eisner and Diller and as lieutenants Jeffrey Katzenberg, Don Steele, Don Simpson, they were smart cookies. And for a while, they had some success coming up with in-house ideas. And it was kind of a return to the studio system without the studio contracts. Everybody was still freelance, but the studio was back in charge. The auteurs were no longer dictating what movies could be made. The studios were, and that is pretty much persisted since.
And so again,
if anything, it's gotten worse.
To talk about it as a studio system in the sense that, you know, we're picking writers to write our ideas.
Right.
And another thing that this is the – one of the things that we think about modern screenwriting is the screenwriter sitting in a room with 10 executives around, you know, outnumbered, outgunned, throwing these notes at them saying, you got to change this, you got to change this. This is the first time that we start really seeing that.
We start seeing that. And, you know, I worked at Disney in the 80s, and there was a phrase that went around that everybody's kind of familiar with, and that was the sense that the Disney executives really felt that they could write the screenplays if only they had the time, that since they were so busy, they had to farm the work out to this glorified stenographer who would take their notes and put down their ideas and somehow bring back the artifact, bring back the hard copy. And, you know, screenwriting in some ways has gotten worse as a profession. These days, there's lots of demands for free rewrites outside the contract. There's lots of deals that don't give writers a chance for a second draft, that really toss them out after a first draft. It's gotten very competitive, and it's not a lot of fun.
And you had technology changing the business as well. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, technology changes in the industry about every 20 years. You can go back to the teens and say there was a technology change when movies changed from one-reelers to features. A whole new audience came in. A whole new middle-class audience came to these more ambitious movies. There was a change when there was sound. Sound allowed the 30s, the great high watermark of American film, going. Television came in. CGI came in. And then essentially home video in the mid-80s, starting with VHS and going to DVDs in the 90s. And every time one of these changes comes in, the audience increases. The number of consumers for recorded entertainment increases, and the chance for the companies that own the copyrights for what we do to make money increases. And writers have just seen that every time there's one of these shifts, the conglomerates are going to make a bundle.
So, Mark Norman, what happens next for screenwriters?
Who the heck knows? I know there will be something like a screenwriter wherever the entertainment industry goes. When we're looking at movies on the inside of our glasses, somebody will write them and somebody will be a screenwriter. It may not be called a screenwriter, but somebody will be doing that and probably fighting the same fights that screenwriters and television writers are fighting now.
Are part of those fights screenwriters not being willing to make the change to to seeing their role change?
It's always the same battle. It's screenwriters and television writers seeing their product as they create it in the perfect theater or on the perfect TV screen of their mind and wanting it to come out that way, or hoping it'll come out that way, and then passing it on to all these human beings who can only push it along, the director, the actors, the crew, who bring their best efforts and are totally essential but are human.
It seems like the problem's innate in any an ensemble art form. It's just the nature of the beast.
I think it is. I think smart writers figure out a way around it.
By becoming directors, by becoming producers.
By becoming directors or just becoming people who can join a work group and add to it instead of drawing lines in the sand and being stubborn and putting their head down and defending what they've done.
Mark Norman's new book is called What Happens Next, A History of American Screenwriting. He's a Hollywood screenwriter who won two Oscars for Shakespeare in Love in 1999, one for Best Screenplay with Tom Stoppard and the other for Best Picture with all the producers of that film. He's also been on the negotiating committee for the WGA during the current labor dispute. Mark Norman, thank you for joining us on The Business.
Thank you.
After a short break, Hollywood burns while gaming explodes. Stick around. It's The Business from NPR.
Ice Cube is down with the PE. Now every single bitch want to see me. Big Daddy is smooth word to mother. Out a flick that exploits the color. Rolling through Hollywood late at night. Red and blue lights with a common sight. Pull to the curb, get played like a sucker. Don't fight the power. Yeah.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The strike seems to be just the latest bad news for show business. DVD sales are flat, record revenue is plummeting, and the audience for broadcast TV is shrinking. But while traditional media struggles to adapt to the digital age, video game revenues are up a whopping 49% this year, fueled by mega hits like Halo 3 and the Nintendo Wii game console. Rather than watch their audience abandon them for more digital pursuits, some media companies are getting into the video game themselves. Variety's video game guy Ben Fritz tells us about how a major media company is taking on one of video game's biggest franchises and how the ensuing battle could be a boon for record labels and a threat to movies and television.
The crowd cheers. The drummer starts the beat. Then the guitarist hits the opening chords. We're not in a rock club, but a soundproof demo room at MTV headquarters in Los Angeles. There are speakers everywhere, and on several big screens, a high-def virtual quartet is rocking out as colored notes fall in front of them. Watching the screen intently are two young video game producers, playing a scaled-down drum kit and guitar-like controller, guided by those colored notes.
So there's now a drum and a guitar lines on the bottom with different colors falling, telling them what to play, and the lyrics are on top, and the notes are going up and down to say what he should sing.
They're showing off Rock Band, the result of MTV's $200 million incursion into the video game industry. In a battle of the band games, MTV's new Rock Band is taking on Guitar Hero, the mega-hit franchise that sold more than 7 million units in the past 2 years. Guitar Hero is a brainchild of two MIT graduates who spent more than a decade trying to find a way to make music easier to play. Alex Rigopoulos was one of those students. He's now CEO of Harmonix, the company that designed Guitar Hero.
When we started the company, actually, we weren't thinking about video games at all. We were really just motivated to fix what we believe to be a problem in the world that needed fixing, which is that playing music is one of the most profoundly joyful experiences that life has to offer. And everybody feels this kind of innate urge to make music, and yet very few people actually get to have access to what it feels like.
After its first few music games didn't hit a chord with the public, Harmonix came up with a guitar-shaped video game controller combined with an addictive on-screen interface that's easy to learn and difficult to master. But the only publisher willing to take a risk on it was a small Northern California-based startup called Red Octane. Dusty Welch is now head of publishing for the company.
There were very low expectations both from retailers and I would say the gaming press, but retailers had begun to start selling out of the product and had begun to request multiple thousands upon thousands of units of the product as replenishment, to the delight, obviously, of the owners at Red Octane, who were at the time, I would say, pleasantly unprepared for the magnitude and the scale of what was to come for the product.
Despite the success of Guitar Hero, the band behind it broke up after a little more than a year. Red Octane, which owned the rights to the Guitar Hero name, was bought by Activision, one of the industry's biggest publishers. But Harmonix, the company that designed the software, was acquired by MTV.
Gaming is such an important part of our target audience at MTV that we had been looking and spending a lot of time thinking about what was the right kind of strategic plays in the gaming space.
Executive Vice President Jeff Yap says MTV understands that more and more of its audience are gamers.
The best place for MTV to make a significant investment in the gaming space was through music.
MTV isn't the only entertainment company making a play for video games. Both Disney and Warner Brothers, for instance, have been investing substantially in games. And Sony, maker of the PlayStation console, is an industry giant. But MTV made a huge splash by paying an astonishing $175 million to get Harmonix, the brains behind Guitar Hero, even though they didn't get the name. Harmonix co-founder and CEO Alex Rigopoulos.
That was the point at which actually we had finally had the resources to develop the game we had really been dreaming of for many, many years, which is Rock Band.
True to its name, Rock Band takes the Guitar Hero experience and adds drums and a microphone so that up to four people can play together in person or online.
The drumming gameplay, of course, is a major leap forward for us.
So you can see there's a big orange line that represents the kick pedal. And otherwise, the four pads represent both cymbals and drums. So right now,
with Rock Band, you don't just play like a rock star. You can look like one, kind of. See, you create your own avatar, which is like a personal digital likeness, from an amazing number of options. Think expertly animated dress-up dolls and you'll kind of get the picture.
So some of the faces you can choose from, for example, I got the meathead up here. He's got a real big manly jaw, some 5 o'clock shadow. here's Babyface, very round face, big blue eyes, little pug nose. The Iron Man looks like he's been on a few gigs. He's got nice big cheekbones.
You can choose your eye color, hairstyles, even tattoos. As you tour with your band, you can acquire clothes, new instruments, and other rock accoutrements. And you can even share your band's music on the web, a la MySpace. In fact, both Guitar Hero and Rock Band have invested in sites that feature high scores, tournaments, and more. They want to turn their games into online social networking experiences that draw in players for hours each day and, incidentally, keep them from watching movies and TV. And that's not all. If the laws of the video game business hold, then sequels to Rock Band and Guitar Hero 3 will definitely be hitting shelves in 2008.
You can see many of the same franchises in the top 10 every single year.
Red Octane's Dusty Welch.
Whether that's Call of Duty, Tony Hawk, Need for Speed, Madden, to name several of them. And if you look back, you see that they're pretty consistent every year. And I think consumers have come to really demand a return of their favorite franchises and have the chance to enjoy and engage in that entertainment experience on an annual or even more frequent basis, unlike what you experience with movies.
While MTV and Activision duke it out now and in the future, there's one clear winner. That's the music industry. See, Guitar Hero 3 includes 71 songs by artists like the Rolling Stones, Guns N' Roses, and Pearl Jam, while Rock Band's playlist has 58 from the likes of The Police, R.E.M., and The Strokes. Both companies also plan to make hundreds more songs available for download in the next year, and the sagging music industry gets a royalty for every single one.
There's a pretty significant revenue stream that is going in to publishers, labels, to the artists, everyone that's involved, that they didn't anticipate.
As for the games themselves, Guitar Hero 3 Legends of Rock came out earlier this month and earned $115 million at $100 a pop in its first week, making it the second most successful video game launch of the year. The more expensive Rock Band just hit shelves last week. Only time will tell whether consumers prefer to be a Guitar Hero or form their own Rock Band, or whether there's enough room in the market for both games to prosper. But with two awesome music games out this month, I think I know what I'll be doing.
So are you guys ready to rock?
Yeah, let's
rock!
Do it!
Go!
Woo!
I got bass.
A postscript, Beowulf, Robert Zemeckis' animated update of the old English epic poem, has been killing at the box office. Does its success have anything to do with the fact that the film looks and feels like a video game? I'm just saying. And that's The Business. I produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Matt Holzman. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.